Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Dallas, and
it's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. We got through it. If you remember last week, ladies and gentlemen, we could not get the sound to work right. We had 3 and 4 starts with the same audio sound bites, but this week it worked fine. And Audrey, thank you for straightening all that out. And I know it wasn't your fault last week. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and Johnny Cash. We want to thank you again for taking us on that trip through 90 cities and states across the United States. And I think we can say again this week, hope you got your earmuffs on and neck scarf, because it's going to be a cold one tonight, I think, in most places, at least across the Midwest and the upper northern part of the country. Emily and Mike, good to see both you in there tonight. And Emily, you have a very special role tonight, and we'll keep that a secret for just a few moments later, but we break Jumble Justice radio history tonight, and Emily has a big part in doing that. Our show has the same purpose that it does every week, ladies and gentlemen. That's to discuss our news, issues, and events and developments in this very interesting and sometimes difficult field called criminal justice. And certainly we try to also pay attention to some of the humor in the field once in a while, too. I think you have to have a sense of humor to actually survive criminal justice practice over any long period of time. But our show is dedicated to those energetic and tireless police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. And again, that's becoming more and more common, our U.S. justice agents serving and advising and helping out in some overseas type of capacity. What we try to do in this show is look inside criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals and what they do. And we do that both in present time, and we've been spending some time here and there in the last few weeks looking at criminal justice practice historically. And we have a very special treat for you tonight. If you like criminal justice history, you will certainly enjoy this show. We're on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and I tell you, every week it amazes me more and more what's being done on that network. You can go to blogtalkradio.com and see all the different shows, and I'm finally doing accounting of all those and for a paper that I'm writing. And the shows are divided up now into this week into 66 different categories, And if I ask you, well, you folks know here on the set, but if I ask you how many shows that Blog Talk Radio has done in something like 14, 16 months, whatever it is, it's been done, but it's 30,000 radio shows. Yes, I said it, 30,000 radio shows in 66 categories. Isn't that just incredible? And I think the smallest number of shows that I could tell was for golf. I think they only had like 9 shows. Then if you look at something like sports, I think it's, 3,900, maybe 4,300, something like that. So, and then you look at religion and politics, those are also very large categories of show. But imagine that, 30,000 shows, and Alan Levy is the genius behind this, and he really started this as a way to have a little posted site where they could make some audio comments relative to a death of a person in his family. Maybe we'll talk a little bit later about that when I'm finished with that paper. But what's possible in this Blog Talk Radio Network is that any person, that means you, any interest group, that interest can run from cigars to astronomy, from darts to homicide investigation. You can have your own show broadcasting live in streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And yes, it's absolutely free. Worldwide broadcasting, any person, unlimited number of listeners, not like it was 8-10 years ago, where that number of listeners was limited, and it cost you absolutely nothing. Can you imagine it? We've had radio stations go out of business, small radio stations, college stations, things like that, because they couldn't afford it. Well, they can afford it now because they can do it on the Blog Talk Radio Network. So I'm fond of saying that, like that motto on the back of the Cheez-Its box, get your own box where you can get your own show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And I'm still amazed that some folks in the criminal justice field have not picked up on this as much as I thought they would have. Well, tonight's show is going to be the usual. We'll have some of the usual. We'll have me commenting on the news and perhaps a couple others, and then we'll have some listener call-ins, if possible. And we'll have to do it pretty quick because our commentary tonight is fairly long, and then we're going to take a look at one of the stories out of Arthur Train's book. Arthur Train's book is called The True Stories of Crime. 1908 is when it was published, and Arthur Train was a New York County district attorney in the early part of the 20th century. And the story that we're going to do tonight is called A Flight into Texas, and it is one of the most remarkable criminal justice stories that you'll ever hear concerning an escape, a flight, the chase, the arrest, and the extradition of this criminal back to New York from Texas when he was, in fact, on the way to Mexico. It involves marshals, it involves Texas Rangers, it involves New York City cops, New Orleans police, and New Orleans police chief. I mean, on and on and on. The coordination and the miscoordination among all these entities to finally bring this gentleman back to justice in New York State. So I think you'll enjoy this show. We're going to try something a little different. Audrey is going to use her wonderful voice and precise diction to read us that story, chapter 10 out of that 10. I think I said 9, but it's chapter 10 out of that book, 1908 book called True Stories of Crime, written by Arthur Train, who was New York County District Attorney at that time. What you can do as a listener, of course, is listen on your computer with the Windows Media Player. You can call in by phone, cell, landline, Skype, whatever you choose. You can hear the whole show on the phone. So if you call in and want to comment early on some of these news stories when we get started, the number is 347-996-5983, and I can hold 5 calls at a time, and we can all talk to each other, and you can hear the show. The shows, of course, are archived within about 10 minutes when they're all done and when we're finished broadcasting live, and you can either download those or replay them anytime you want. So if you happen to find anything on Blog Talk Radio Network that you think you could use for an instructional class, or just your own enjoyment, you can replay them as often as you like. All right, here we go tonight. This would be the time when Audrey, who is a blonde, would be telling us one more of her litany of blonde jokes, but tonight we break history because we are going to have the first blonde male joke. And I know, Audrey, that you said that you would not do this one because you were afraid to take the heat from the blonde-haired men. That's not the real case, but we've decided, Audrey and I, that we're going to allow Emily to do all the blonde male jokes when we have them. Now, we don't plan on having many, but tonight we have a blonde male joke, and Emily, are you ready to go with that joke? I can see Harold, my goldfish, over here. He's so excited about it. Listen to him. Oh, settle down now, Aaron. Settle down. But we're going to have our first blonde male joke on the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Here we go.
Here is the first ever blonde male joke. I hope you like it. Professor Haley. An Irishman, a Mexican, and a blonde guy were doing construction work on scaffolding on the 20th floor of a building. They were eating lunch and the Irishman said, "Corned beef and cabbage. If I get corned beef and cabbage one more time for lunch, I'm going to jump off this building." The Mexican opened his lunch box and exclaimed, "Burritos again. If I get burritos one more time, I'm going to jump off too." The blondie opened his lunch and said, "Bologna again. If I get a bologna sandwich one more time, I'm jumping too." The next day, the Irishman opened his lunch box, saw corned beef and cabbage, and jumped to his death. The Mexican opened his lunch, saw a burrito, and jumped too. The blonde guy opened his lunch, saw the bologna, and jumped to his death as well. At the funeral, the Irishman's wife was weeping. She said, "If I'd known how really tired he was of corned beef and cabbage, I never would have given it to him again." The Mexican's wife also wept and said, "I could have given him tacos or enchiladas. I didn't realize he hated burritos so much. Oh, this is good." Everyone turned and stared at the blonde's wife. The blonde's wife said, "Don't look at me. He makes his own lunch."
All right, we could not have had a better one for the first time out on the blonde male joke on the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Thank you very much, Emily, for running that one, letting that one down. Now, ladies and gentlemen, at this time we always like to play the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence and their radio public service ad. This is an ad that goes out to all the gangbangers and street criminals to try to get them to stop carrying weapons.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Coalition. It certainly is a deadly idea, and I hope that all the street criminals that advertisement is added or is directed to are able to hear that and act accordingly. Our first news story tonight is kind of an interesting one. Taser is ubiquitous in terms of the police service. It's been used, I think, 70,000 times plus in the United States and a lot of times in Canada. But here's a story about a bicyclist tased when he runs for a minor infraction. He's actually not been tased on the while he was riding the bicycle, but a man was riding a bicycle in Hamilton City, and he had improper lighting equipment. He was shot with a taser gun Wednesday night as he ran from a deputy who tried to stop him for the light infraction. Says after repeated attempts, Glenn County Sheriff Deputy Cale Smith said he finally got the attention of the rider on Sierra Street who jumped from the bike and began running. After a half-block chase and several warnings from Smith, he said that he would use the taser, and he did. Sergeant Scott James said only one probe struck the man, identified as Omar Harada Rivera, age 39, and he received no electric shock. So they didn't complete the circuit there, I guess. But Smith caught up with him near the garage of the home and took him into custody after a brief struggle. James said Smith was fully justified in firing his taser because Rivera was running toward a home and could have endangered people inside. And of course, they considered the taser the same level of force of weapon that you would use in terms of pepper spray or baton, sort of immediate range defense weapon. He added that deputies don't deploy tasers against subjects who are driving or riding a bike because of the risk factor. I guess it would be a little dangerous that 5 seconds that you're out, you certainly couldn't control your bike. So anyway, the story goes on, and then at the end they mention a number of other things. Rivera was transported to Glenn Medical Center, where he was cleared for booking into the Glenn County Jail on suspicion of resisting arrest, riding a bike without proper lighting, riding under the influence of alcohol, and using false citizenship government documents. So he was an illegal alien. So interesting. Follow up on the taser idea. Here's something that's coming, and I don't know how we can turn back some of this technology. There's going to be a shotgun taser. Taser's out testing the thing now and working with some folks, but this Arizona-based company, Taser, who makes the stun guns, is developing a new device that's launched from a 12-gauge shotgun, and this shotgun can actually fire the electric charge as far away as 20 meters, so very interesting. I suspect that this would have to be faster in terms of the velocity of the cartridges that are not the cartridge, but the expenditure, the prongs, when they go out. But it doesn't say anything about that in the article, but leave it to Taser to develop something new. Let me go on down here and talk about some of the cases in the United States where as many as 300 deaths have been attributed to the Taser or related to the use of the Taser, but those have really not been proved. It's about 270 cases, adding was listed as contributing factor, but not the sole factor in the death of some people. Canada's had 16 deaths relative to the use of the taser, but here comes the shotgun taser, and looks like it's going to be used. The other one, the small ones, only shoot about 8 meters, so this is going to almost triple the distance. It's the same shock. They get 50,000 volts that go through them and debilitate them for about 5 seconds until the police can come in and get full control. That's sort of interesting. Here's an old-fashioned idea. You get a new police chief in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia doesn't have the lowest crime rates in the world, but members of the police department there are applauding the new commissioner, Charles Ramsey, who came from Washington, D.C., with his new crime-fighting plan, which promises a return to the fundamentals of policing. And what's he talking about? Well, first of all, he's going to add 200 more cops on the street. That always helps if you're trying to bring the crime rate down. We used to argue about that, but now we know it properly deployed. More police do, in fact, reduce crime. And he's going to beef up patrols in 9 different districts. And then he's going to encourage more stop and frisk searches, which are legal searches. You have to pat down first, and then if you detect what you would think would be a hard metallic object that could be interpreted as a weapon, then, of course, you can go inside. And inside a pocket, for example, coat pocket, and do the search. And then they're going to install about 200 more surveillance cameras before the end of the year. So as you read this article, you run down through it, it sounds like, this chief is interested in doing some rather old-fashioned policing, the kind of policing that's been successful in New York City and Boston and some other places that really drove crime down in the late 1990s and early part of the 21st century. So it'll be interesting. The chief says he's not advocating random stopping of people in these high crime districts, but if people raise suspicion to the level of reasonable suspicion, then of course they're going to be stopped and patted down. So kind of an interesting idea. I mentioned this last week to anybody that might be listening, but it's a very nice brochure concerning policing. But the Irving, Texas Police Department is going to be giving their test up in the area from where we broadcast here, not too far away, in Michigan on Saturday, April 12th, 2008 at 10 a.m. They're going to do it at 2 different locations. And if you're interested in that, just go to officer.com, go to the Texas site, and then go to the Irving Police Department, and you'll be able to get all the information there in terms of how to get going for that. But very nice starting salary from the academy. You get $48,800. And then 6 months, it goes up to over $50,000. Then in about 8.5 years, it goes up to $66,000. 4-year college degree pays an extra $100. Associate's $50. Bilingual pay can be anything from $60 to $250. And you can be 21 to 44. I'm surprised they have that upper age limit. But certainly a department that respects and seeks out those who have education. So be very interesting thing to look at. It's a very nice brochure. They hand out. They even give you the climate, what it's like. And my gosh, it would be about 55 down there today in terms of a high, and the low would not even make freezing. So not a bad place to be. It's loaded with all kinds of activity, of course, baseball, hockey, motor speedway racing, on and on and on. So it would be an interesting place to work, and I imagine with overtime, you'd probably be pushing $100,000 down there in a year's time. So an interesting place to look. Well, tonight we're going to do something that is very unusual. We're going to go back to the early 1900s, early part of the 20th century, and we're going to look at one of the stories that was written. These are all true stories based on his experience. Written by Mr. Arthur Train, and he was a New York County District Attorney in 1908. It's when the book was published. The book is called True Stories of Crime, and this is one called A Flight into Texas. And this case is very interesting. It's a flight of a gentleman named Charles Dodge, and what he did and why will be explained in our reading tonight. But it's a tremendous case in terms of how complicated an extradition can be, at least in the early part of the 20th century. It involves local police and marshals and state police and the Texas Rangers, criminals and attorneys that aren't as clean as they should be in terms of operating their practice. And I think it's going to be a very interesting thing to listen to. So we're going to go ahead and get started on that. I think we have time to get the whole thing in before the show is over. So listen up, get your notepad out, and I think you're going to enjoy A Flight into Texas as part of the book True Stories of Crime by Arthur Train, 1908. Well, I agree. Are you all set to go with this? Let's go ahead and give it a try.
A Flight into Texas. The flight and extradition of Charles F. Dodge unquestionably involved one of the most extraordinary battles with justice in the history of the criminal law. The funds at the disposal of those who were interested in procuring the prisoner's escape were unlimited in extent, and the arch conspirator for whose safety Dodge was spirited away was so influential in political and criminal circles that he was all but successful. In defying the prosecutor of New York County, even supported as the latter was by the military and judicial arm of the United States government. For, at the time that Dodge made his escape, a whisker from Hummel was enough to make the dry bones of many a powerful and ostensibly respectable official rattle and the tongue cleave to the roof of his mouth in terror. Who could accomplish that in which the law was powerless? Hummel, who could drive to the uttermost ends of the earth persons against whom not a shadow of suspicion had previously rested. Hummel, who dictated to the chiefs of police of foreign states what they should or should not do in certain cases, and who could, at the beckoning of his little finger, summon to his dungeon like officers in the New York Life Building, whither his firm had removed from Center Street, the most prominent of lawyers, the most eminent of citizens. Surely none but Hummel. And now Hummel was fighting for his own life. The only man that stood between him and the iron bars of Blackwell's Island was Charles F. Dodge, the man whom he had patted on the knee in his office and called a mascot when, quite in the nature of business, he needed a little perjury. Your sister wealthy client. Hummel and Terre called into play every resource upon which, during 40 years of practice, his tiny tentacles had fastened. Crucial theory that, while he made a show of enjoying himself like he was his accustomed light-heartedness in the tendering, he did not feel confident that in the end this barrel would disappear like the others which had from time threatened him during his criminal career. But Hummel was fully aware of the tenacity of the man who had resolved to rid New York of his malign influence. His nemesis was following him in his dreams. Ever dreamed. It probably took the shape of the square-shouldered district attorney in the shadow of whose office building the little chose to practice his profession. Had he been told that this nemesis was in reality a jovial little man with a round, ruddy face and twinkling blue eyes, he would have laughed as heartily as it was in his power to laugh. Yet such was the fact. A little man who looked less like a detective than a commercial traveler selling St. Peter's oil or some other cheerful concoction, with manners as gentle and a voice as soft as a spring zephyr, who always took off his hat when he came into a business office, seemingly bashful to the point of self-effacement, was the one who snatched Charles F. Dodge from the borders of Mexico and held him in an iron grip when every influence upon which Hunnell could call for aid, from crooked police officials, corrupt judges, and a gang of cutthroats under the guise of a sheriff's posse, were fighting for his release. Jesse Blocker is not employed in New York County, and for business reasons he does not wish his present address known. When he comes to New York, he occasionally drops into the writer's office for a cigar and a friendly chat about old times. And as he sits there and talks so modestly, and with such quiet humor about his adventures with the Texas Rangers among the cactus-studded trainees of the Lone Star State, it's hard even for one who knows the truth to realize that this man is one of the greatest of detectives, or rather one of the most capable, resourceful, adroit, and quick-witted knights of adventure who ever set forth upon a seemingly impossible errand. It is unnecessary to state just how the district attorney discovered the existence of Jesse, as we knew him. Is enough to say that on Saturday morning, July the 23rd, 1904, he was furnished with the proper credentials and given instructions to proceed at once to New Orleans, Louisiana, and locate, if it was humanly possible to do so, Charles F. Dodge, under indictment for perjury, and potentially the chief witness against Abraham H. Hunnell, on a charge of conspiracy. He was told briefly, and to the point that, in spite of the official reports from the police headquarters of both New York City and New Orleans to the contrary, there was reason to believe that Dodge was living, although not registered, as a guest at the St. Charles Hotel in the latter city. A partial and inaccurate description of Dodge was given him, and he was warned to use extreme caution to prevent any knowledge of his mission from being made known. Once Dodge had been discovered, he was to keep him under surveillance and wire in New York immediately. Accordingly, Jesse left the city upon the same day at 4:45 p.m. and arrived 2 days later, at 9:15 on Monday morning, at New Orleans, where he went directly to the St. Charles Hotel, registered, and was assigned to room number 547 on the fifth floor. Somewhere in the hotel, Dodge was secreted. The question was how to find him. For an hour, Jesse sat in the hotel foyer and meditatively watched the visitors come and go, but saw no sign of his quarry. Then he arose, put on his hat, and hunted out a stationery store, where for 2 cents he bought a bright red envelope. He then visited a ticket scalper's office, secured the owner's business card, and rode in a Teamster back to Dodge, offering him cheap transportation to any point that he might desire. Armed with this, he returned to the hotel, walked to the desk, glanced casually over a number of telegrams exposed in a rack, and, when the clerk turned his back, placed the note, addressed to Charles F. Dodge, unobserved, upon the counter. The office was a busy one. Guests were constantly depositing their keys and receiving their mail. And, even as Jesse stood there watching developments, the clerk turned round, found a note, and promptly placed it in box number 420. The very simple scheme had worked, and quite unconsciously the clerk had indicated the number of the room occupied by Dodge. Jesse lost no time in ascending to the fourth floor, used room number 420, returned to the desk, told the clerk that he was dissatisfied with the room assigned him, and requested that he be given either room number 421, 423, or 425, one of which he stated that he had occupied on a previous visit. After some discussion, the clerk allotted him room number 423, which was almost directly opposite that occupied by Dodge, and the detective at once took up his task of watching for the fugitive to appear. Within the hour, the door opened and Dodge and the companion, and subsequently proved to be E.M. Bracken, alias Bradley, an agent employed by Howland Hummel, left the room, went to the elevator and descended to the dining room upon the second floor. Jesse watched until they were safely ensconced at breakfast, and then returned to the fourth floor, where he tipped the chambermaid, told her that he had left his key at the office, and induced her to unlock the door of room number 420, which she did under the supposition that Jesse was the person who had left the chamber in Dodge's company. The contents of the room convinced Jesse that he had found Dodge, but he discovered there two grips bearing Dodge's name as well as several letters on the table addressed to him. The detective returned to the hall and had a little talk with the maid. "The old gentleman with you has been quite sick," he said. "How is he today?" "He is some better," answered Jesse. "Yes, he does look better today," she added, "but he surely was powerful sick yesterday. Why, he hasn't been out of his room before for 5 or 6 days. This statement was corroborated by Dodge's physical appearance, but he looked haggard and worn. Jesse was now confident that he had found Dodge, in spite of the reports of the New Orleans police to the contrary, and he was also reasonably sure that the fugitive was too sick to leave the hotel immediately. He therefore telegraphed his superiors that he had discovered Dodge, and that the latter was at the St. Charles Hotel. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Jesse received a wire from New York as follows: New Orleans Police Department claims party not there. Left for Mexico 3 weeks ago. Ascertain correct destination and wire at once. Jesse at once replied no question as to identity and presence here at this time. He now took up the task of keeping his quarry under absolute surveillance for a night, which duty from that moment he continued for a period of nearly 10 months. During the remainder of the afternoon, and throughout the night, Dodge and Bracken remained in room number 420, and during the evening, were visited by several strangers, including a plainclothes officer from the New Orleans police headquarters. Little Hummel, dining in Long Acre Square in the glare of Broadway, was pressing some invisible button that transmitted the power of his influence even to the police government of a city 2,000 miles away. The following day, January 26th, at about 8:40 in the morning, Dodge and Bracken descended to the lobby. Bracken departed from the hotel, leaving Dodge to pay the bill at the cashier's window, and Jesse heard him order a cab for the 11:30 a.m. Sunset Limited on the Southern Pacific Railroad and direct that his baggage be removed from his room. Jesse did the same. In the meantime, Bracken returned and promptly at 11 a.m. left for the railroad station in a cab with Dodge. Jesse followed in another. As the two passed through the gates, the detective caught a glimpse of Dodge's ticket and saw that it had been issued by the Mexican National Railway. Retiring to the telegraph office in the station, he wired New York as follows: bird flying. Sunset Limited. Destination not known. I am with him. He then hastily purchased a ticket to Houston, Texas, and boarded the train. Dodge's companion had bidden him goodbye as the engine started, and Jesse's task now became that of ferreting out Dodge's destination. After some difficulty, he managed to get a glimpse of the whole of the fugitive's ticket, and thus discovered that he was on his way to the city of Mexico, via Eagle Pass, Texas. While from the Pullman conductor, he learned that Dodge had secured sleeping car accommodation as far as San Antonio, Texas, only. So far all was well. He knew Dodge, but Dodge did not know him, and later on in the afternoon he had the satisfaction of a long talk with his quarry in the observation car, where they amiably discussed together current events, and argued politics with the same vehemence as if they had been commercial travelers thrown fortuitously into each other's company. Dodge, however, cleverly evaded any reference to his destination. When the train reached Morconcy, Louisiana, at 3 p.m., which was the first stop, Jesse wired New York as follows on Sunset Limited with friend. He has transportation to the city of Mexico, via Eagle Pass, where I am now journeying with him. Answer to Beaumont, Texas. Later in the afternoon, he sent an additional message from Lafayette, Louisiana. Have seen transportation of friend and am positive of destination. Judge was occupying section 3 of the sleeping car Capitola and, as became an invalid, retired early. At Beaumont, Jesse failed to receive any reply to his various messages, and when the train arrived at Houston, no word came from New York until it was almost the time of departure. Waiting until practically the last moment, Jesse hurried through the gates of the Union Station at Houston and bought a ticket to San Antonio. As he was leaving the ticket window, night chief of police John Howard and two officers came hurrying up, inquiring anxiously for Mr. Jesse. The reinforcements had arrived. Outside on the track, the Sunset Limited was just getting underway. The first frantic puffs were being vomited from the funnel. Side Judge was sleeping peacefully in his berth. Jesse, accompanied by Chief Howard, hurried up to the conductor who was about to swing onto the steps of the sleeper and ordered him to hold the train till the fugitive could be removed. After some argument, the conductor grumblingly complied, and Judge was aroused from pleasant dreams of the Creole Quarter to the cold reality of being dragged out of bed by a policeman. Was unceremoniously hustled out of the sleeping car into a carriage and taken to headquarters, where he admitted his identity and remarked, "I know what I'm wanted for, but I will never return to New York." In his grip was found the sum of $1,563.15, as well as numerous letters from the law firm of Howe and Hummel, and a quantity of newspaper clippings relative to his case. Judge pleaded with Chief Howard not to lock him up, urging that he was a sick man and offering goodly sum might be taken to a hotel and guarded for the remainder of the night. But what went in New Orleans did not go in Houston, and the best that Judge could get for himself was a cot in the ladies' detention room on the second floor of the jail. Early the following morning, Jesse visited police headquarters and for the first time met George Ellis, chief of police of Houston, for whom he will always have a feeling of deep gratitude for his enthusiastic cooperation and loyalty in the many stirring events that followed. Judge now received a telegram from New York, which was submitted to Jesse before reaching the prisoner, to the effect that Howe and Hummel were sending on an attorney to aid the fugitive in resisting extradition and informing him that they had employed Mr. Hamden Miles as attorney to look out for his welfare. These last immediately jumped in medias res, and on the afternoon of the same day, secured writ of habeas corpus from Norman J. Cottrell, District Judge of Harris County, Texas, returnable the following morning. The next day, January 28, Cottrell released Dodge from custody. Jesse had anticipated this and immediately swore out another warrant with the result that the prisoner was rearrested before he left the courtroom. Meantime, the Dodge interests retained another firm of lawyers, Smith, Andrews and Ball, who, on the following day, secured a second writ of habeas corpus from Judge Ash. The result of the first engagement being a draw, counsel on both sides agreed that this writ should not be returnable for 6 days. During this period, District Attorney Jerome employed Smith, Baker, Fox, Parker, and Garwood to represent him, and secured from Governor Adela Torbini a requisition on Governor Lanham of Texas for the extradition of the prisoner, which he entrusted to Detective Sergeant Herlihy of the New York Police. Herlihy reached Houston with the papers on the evening of January 30th, and on the same train with him came Abraham Kaffenberg, a member of the law firm of Howard Hamill, and a nephew of the latter. Likewise also came Bracken, still styling himself Ian Bradley, and from now on Bracken was the inseparable companion, guide, philosopher and friend of the unfortunate Judge, whose continued existence upon this earth had become such a menace to the little lawyer in New York. Herlihy, accompanied by Judge Garwood, proceeded direct to Austin, where they found Judge already represented by Miss Andrews and Ball, who, at the hearing before Governor Lanham, made a strong effort to induce that executive to refuse to honor the requisition of the governor of New York. This effort failed, and Governor Lanham issued his warrant, But Herlihy had no sooner returned to Houston for the purpose of taking possession of the prisoner than he was served with an injunction enjoining him, together with Chief of Police Ellis, from taking Dodge into custody, pending hearing upon a new habeas corpus which had been issued by Judge Wallace E. Burns of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas. This new writ was returnable February 9th. After exhaustive but futile argument by the counsel for Dodge, Judge Burns remanded the prisoner to Herlihy's custody to be returned to the state of New York, but this decision had no sooner been rendered than an appeal was taken therefrom by Dodge's lawyers, and the prisoner released upon bail fixed to $20,000. During this period, Dodge was quartered under guard at the Rice Hotel in Houston, and the day following the argument, the $20,000 bail was put up in cash and Dodge released from custody. In the meantime, however, Jesse, knowing that no sum, however large, would deter Hummel from spiriting Dodge out of the country, had made his arrangements to secure a new extradition warrant from the governor of Texas. So that is, the prisoner did succeed in getting beyond the Southern District of the Federal Court of Texas. He could be seized and conveyed to New York. Of course, someone had to keep watch over Dodge, while Jesse hurried to Austin to see the governor, and it was decided to make Sergeant Herlihy, reinforced by a number of local detectives for that purpose. But while the watchful Jesse was away, Bracken proceeded to get busy in the good old Howe and Hummel fashion. Lots of people that Herlihy had never seen before turned up and protested that he was the finest fellow they had ever met. And as Herlihy was, in fact, a good fellow, he made them welcome and dined and wined at their expense until he woke up in the Manger Hotel in San Antonio and inquired where he was. Jesse, meantime, had returned from Austin to discover that Dodge with his companions, Kaffenberg and Bracken, had slipped out of Houston early in the morning of February 11th, after disposing of Herlihy and eluding the watchfulness of Herlihy's assistants. Hummel was leading, and by 10 o'clock the next morning Dodge and his comrades were on board an English merchantman lying in the harbor of Galveston. Later in the same day, the Hummel and Trust started from the Southern Pacific Railroad for the sum of $3,000 for seagoing to Hughes, to which Dodge was now transferred for the purpose of being conveyed to the port of Tampico in the Republic of Mexico. But here Hummel's wives became crossed with James, and unfortunately for the little lawyer, the person from whom the tug had been leased turned out to be closely allied with the prosecution's interests, with the result that the captain of the tug was instructed by his superiors and no consideration put into any Mexican port, but on the contrary, to delay his departure from the harbor of Galveston for a period of 2 days, and then to proceed only as far as Brownsville, Texas, where he should compel the debarkation of the fugitive. The captain, who was a good sport as well as a good officer, promptly threw himself into the part and told Bracken and Kaffenberg that it was evident from the barometer that a severe storm was approaching which must have had a sinister implication to these two unfortunate gentlemen, and that he could not think of putting to sea. Once the storm had blown over, the tug started out across the blue waters of the Gulf of Mexico. But now Bracken and Kaffenberg were informed for the first time that it was impossible to consider putting into any port of the Republic of Mexico, since to do so would cause international complications and compel the revocation of the captain's license. In desperation, the Hummel and Trist offered the captain $5,000 in cash to disregard his instructions and put into Tampico, but the worthy sea dog was adamant. It was probably worth $5,000 to him to see three gentry of the Spatton, so much put about. While Dodge and his accomplices were dallying in the harbor of Galveston, Jesse was taking advantage of his opportunity to proceed at once by railroad to Alice, Texas, which at that time was the furthermost southern point reached by any railway in the direction of Brownsville. On his arrival, he at once applied to Captain John R. Hughes, commanding Company D of the Texas Rangers, who received him with great joy, and ordered a detachment of the Rangers to meet the tug at Point Isabella at the mouth of the Rio Grande River in the border of Mexico. In the meantime, Jesse started on a toilsome stage journey to Brownsville, across 170 miles of desert, which occupied 2 days and nights, and necessitated his going without sleep for that period. During the trip, Jesse heard no word of English and had as his associates only Mexican cattlemen. Every 15 miles, a fresh relay of broncos was hitched to the stage, and after a few moments' rest, the misery began again. Jesse had been hurrying toward Brownsville by stage while Dodge, Gatlinburg, and Bracken were landing at Point Isabella, where they were kept under close surveillance by Sergeant Tom Ross of the Rangers. Then they took the train to Brownsville, registering at the Miller House under the assumed names of Pierre Doherty, A. Koontzman, and D.N. Barker, all of Oklahoma. But, although they knew it not, Sergeant Tom was at their elbow, and had Dodge attempted to cross the border into Mexico, he would instantly have been placed under arrest. As Brownsville was within the Southern District of the Federal Court of Texas, Jesse decided not to arrest Dodge until he should actually attempt flight, and when Dodge and his companions, on the following morning, February 15th, entered the stage the same upon which Jesse had arrived and started for Alice, Jesse and Tom Ross procured the best horses they could find, and started after them, keeping just in sight of the stage. Dodge's intention in making this move was to take the Mexican International Railway at Alice and cross over to Mexico via Laredo. Jesse and Ross covered the 74 miles from Brownsville to Santa Marcos Ranch by 4 in the afternoon, which was fairly strenuous work for a New York detective, and here found themselves so sore and exhausted from the ride that they were glad to hire a pair of horses and buggy with which to complete the journey to Alice. Luckily, they were able to get into telephonic communication with various ranch owners along the road, and arranged to have fresh relays of horses supplied to them every 20 miles, and here also Jesse called up Captain Hughes at Alice, and suggested that he substitute for the regular night clerk at the City Hotel one of the privates of the Rangers by the name of Harrod. Dodge and his companions arrived in Alice on February 17th, and, as Jesse had anticipated, repaired at once to the City Hotel, where, as much as they were dry from the dust of their trip, and oppressed by a lack of society, they entered at once into an enthusiastic and confidential friendship with the man behind the counter in the hotel office, sublimely ignorant that they were unfolding to a member of the Texas Rangers all their most secret intentions. Harrod was just as glad to see Dodge as Dodge apparently was to see Harrod, and kindly offered to assist the fugitive to get into Mexico in any way that the latter desired. Dodge, for his part, took advantage of his usefulness to the extent of requesting him to purchase some railroad tickets, the plan being to leave Alice the following morning for Monterrey, Mexico. 3 hours after the stage bearing Dodge and his party pulled up at the City Hotel, Tom Ross and Jesse drove in behind a pair of fagged-out broncos at 2 a.m. Jesse had had no sleep of any sort, and no proper nourishment for 5 days, and had just strength enough left to drag himself up one flight of stairs and tumble into bed, from which he did not emerge for many hours. In the meantime, they broke and Dodge, Kaffenberg, and Bracken, having break-faced, drove comfortably down to the International Railway Station, and settled themselves in the smoker, but they had no sooner given this direct evidence of their intention before Captain Hughes entered and placed Dodge under arrest. The latter surprise may be appreciated when it is stated that from the time the three had left Houston, they had no idea that they were being followed and believed that they had completely foiled Jesse and his assistants. While Jesse had been chasing Dodge across the desert, his lawyers had not been idle and had secured a toss in another extradition warrant from Governor Lanham, who, on receiving news of the arrest, promptly instructed Captain Hughes by wire to assume charge of the prisoner, and to deliver him into the hands of the New York officer, to be conveyed to New York. There now began such a legal battle as the state of Texas had never known. Hummel had been forced into his last ditch, and was fighting desperately for life. Through Kaffenberg, he had once applied for a new writ of habeas corpus in Wasis County, and engaged counsel at Corpus Christi, to assist in fighting for the release of the prisoner, precisely as Hummel had intended. Writers and Waces rode into Alice and demanded the prisoner from Captain Hughes. As Hummel had not intended, Captain Hughes refused to surrender the prisoner and told Chief Wright to go to Wells. Told him that he intended to obey his commander-in-chief, the governor of Texas. On February 20th, Hummel, through Kassenberg, attempted to get another writ of habeas corpus in B County, and promptly the B chief came buzzing over and demanded Dodge, but to him Hughes replied even as he had spoken to Wright. Excitement in Ellis had now reached such a pitch that Judge Burns, of the federal court in Houston, ordered United States Marshal John W. Van, of Alice, to assume charge of the prisoner. The indomitable Hughes, however, paid no more attention to the United States Marshal than he had to the local chief. But the situation was so delicate, and the clash of authority might so easily have resulted in bloodshed, that it was finally agreed by all parties that the best thing to do was to have the prisoner returned in the joint custody of Captain Hughes of the Rangers and the United States Marshal. Jesse, through his counsel, in proper course made application to forfeit Dodge's bond and remand him to jail, but the Hummel attorneys finally induced the court on the plea that to confine Dodge in jail would be detrimental to his already badly impaired health. To permit the prisoner to go free on a greatly increased bond, nevertheless restricting his movements to Harris County, Texas. While Jesse had fought a winning battle up to this point, he was at the end of his resources so far as the extradition of the prisoner was concerned, but Dodge was now at liberty, pending the decisions upon the habeas corpus proceedings of the United States Circuit Court of Appeals at Fort Worth and the United States Supreme Court at Washington, but his orders were to bring Dodge back to New York. Hence, with the aid of some new men, sent him from the north, he commenced an even closer surveillance of the prisoner than ever before by both their knights. Meantime, Kaffenberg departed for New York, fleeing from the wrath of Judge Burns, who had issued a summons for him for contempt of the federal court on the ground that he had induced Dodge to attempt to jump his bond. In place of the blustering Kaffenberg was sent another member of the famous law firm of Howe and Hummel, David May, an entirely different type of man. May was as mild as the day in June as a bane as Kaffenberg had been insolent. He fluttered into Houston like a white dove at peace with the proverbial olive branch in his mouth. From now on, the tactics employed by the representatives of Hummel were conciliatory in the extreme. Mr. May, however, did not long remain in Houston, as it was apparent that there was nothing to be done by either side pending the action of the court, and in any event Dodge was abundantly supplied with local counsel. The time had now come when Hummel must have begun to feel that the fates were against him, and that a 20-year term in state prison was a concrete possibility even for him. In the meantime, Dodge and Bracken had taken up their headquarters at the Rice Hotel in the low-stakes censored suite of rooms in the house, uneasy in forgetting the prisoner beyond the reach of the New York courts apparently having been concocted. Dodge was now indulged in every conceivable luxury and vice. He was plunged into every sort of excess. There was no debauchery which Bracken could supply that was not his, and their rapid method of existence was soon the talk of the county, and continued to be so for 10 long months. There is more than one way to kill a cat, and more than one method of wiping out the only existing witness against a desperate man striving to escape the consequences of crime. Dodge's daily routine was somewhat as follows. He never slept at his own hotel, but arose in the morning between 10 and 11 o'clock, when he was at once visited by Bracken, and supplied with numerous drinks in lieu of the breakfast for which he never had any desire. At noon the two would have luncheon with more drinks. In the afternoon they would retire to the pool rooms and play the races, and, when the races were over, they would then visit the faro bank, and gamble until midnight or later. Later on they would proceed to another resort on Louisiana Street where Dodge really lived. Here his day may be said to have begun, and here he spent most of his money, frequently paying out as much as $50 a night for wine, and invariably ending in a beastly state of intoxication. It is quite probable that never in the history of debauchery had any one man ever been so indulged in excesses of every sort for the same period of time as Dodge was during the summer and fall of 1904. The fugitive never placed his foot on Mother Earth. They were going only a block, back and called for a cab, and the two seemed to take a special delight in making Jesse, as Jerome's representative, spend as much money in cab hire as possible. But youth and genius never again experienced so profitable a time as they did during Dodge's wet season, and the life of dissipation was continued until, from time to time, the prisoner became so weak from its effects that he was forced to go under the care of a physician. A few days of abstinence always restored his vitality, and he would then start out upon another round of pleasure. During this period, Jesse maintained a close and vigilant personal espionage over the prisoner. For over 10 months he slept less than 4 hours each day, his fatigue being increased by the constant apprehension of treachery among his own men, and the necessity of being ever on the alert to prevent some move on the part of the defense to spirit the prisoner away. During the summer, attempts were repeatedly made to evade the vigilance of Jesse and his men, and several desperate dashes were frustrated by them, including one occasion when Bracken succeeded in rushing Dodger as far as Galveston, where they were forced to abandon their design. From time to time, Bracken would disappear from Houston for a week or 10 days, stating on his return that he had been to New York, after which there was invariably some new move to get the prisoner away. Time and space prevent giving a detailed account of all the marches and countermarches that took place in this battle of wit against wit. In August 1904, Bracken made one of his periodical visits to New York, and when he returned, sought out Jesse and said, "Glucker, you might as well be a good fellow and get yours while you can. I mean that Dodge is not going back to New York, even if it cost $1 million to prevent it." A few days later, Bracken sent a gambler named Warner to Jesse, who offered the latter $3,500 to get lost long enough for the prisoner to slip over to Mexico. Acting upon the advice of his attorney, Jesse encouraged this attempt under the belief that if he could get the Hummel forces in the position of having attempted to bribe him, the prisoner's bail could then be forfeited and Dodge himself taken into custody. Hummel became wary, however, and apparently abandoned for the time the idea of bribery. Later on, Bracken again disappeared. On his return, a marked change was noticeable in his demeanor, and Jesse observed that he was in constant consultation with Dodge, from which the detective drew the inference that some last desperate move was to be made towards the escape of the prisoner. On one occasion, Jesse saw Bracken showing Dodge a map and some drawings on paper, which so excited his suspicions that he followed the two with unremitting assiduity, and within a day or two was rewarded through Bracken's carelessness with an opportunity for going through the latter's coat pockets in the billiard room. Here he found a complete set of plans worked out in every detail for spiriting the prisoner from San Antonio into Mexico during the state fair. These plans were very elaborate, every item having been planned out from the purchase of tickets and passing of baggage through the customs, the hotel accommodation in the city of Mexico and Tampico, and steamship tickets from Tampico to Europe. The plan had been to secure admission from the port for Dodge to leave Houston long enough ostensibly to attend the fair at San Antonio, and to lose him during the excitement and crowded condition of the city at that time. Yes, of course. Needless to say that these plans were abandoned when Bracken discovered that Jesse had been forewarned. Almost immediately thereafter, the Circuit Court of Appeals in Fort Worth, Texas, decided one of the habeas corpus cases adversely to Dodge, but it still permitted him to retain his liberty pending the final determination of the questions involved by the Supreme Court at Washington. The Hummel forces were apparently losing hope, however, for early in October another attempt was made to bribe Jesse. Bracken entered his room one evening and informed him that he could get his own prize. He would only be a good fellow, and even went so far as to exhibit a quantity of money which he stated was $25,000. The only result of this offer was to lead Jesse to redouble his precautions. But he argued that the situation must indeed be acute when such an offer could be deemed worthwhile. Thereafter, it was obvious that the revelry of Dodge and his companions was on the increase. Accordingly, Jesse added to
Log Talk Radio.
1904, Nathaniel Cohen, another member of the firm of Howard Hamel, arrived at Houston, and the next day the Supreme Court at Washington decided the appeal in the habeas corpus against the prisoner, who was at once ordered by Judge Burns into the custody of United States Marshal William M. Hansen. Things looked black indeed for Dodge and blacker still for Hamel. How the little attorney, eating his midday lunch 4,000 miles away, at Wanton's restaurant on Franklin Street, must have trembled in his patent leather boots. His last emissary, Cohen, at once procured an assistant by the name of Brookman, and with him proceeded to Whiting County, Texas, where they secured new writ of habeas corpus, and induced the local sheriff, one which, to swear in a posse committed this of 100 men for the purpose of coming to Houston, take the prisoner by force of arms out of the hands of the United States Marshal. This was one of the most daring and desperate attempts made in recent years to frustrate the law. Jesse believed that the real object of this posse was to precipitate a fight between themselves and the federal authorities. It is not inconceivable that in such an event Dodge might either have escaped or been killed. The men composing the posse were of the most desperate character and consisted largely of the so-called feud factions of Whiting County, known as the Woodpeckers and the Jade Birds. Jesse has been informed, on what he regards as reliable authority, that this move cost the Hamel force of $15,000, and that each member of the posse received $100 for his contemplated services in the rescue of the prisoner. But civil war, even on a small scale, cannot be indulged in without some inkling of the facts becoming known to the authorities, and prior to the receipt of the mandate to the Supreme Court, Judge Burns ordered the prisoner removed to Galveston for safekeeping. This long, expensive and arduous struggle came finally to an end. The Judge Burns in before ordered that Charles F. Dodge should be conveyed to New York in the personal custody of the United States Marshal, and delivered by him to the New York authorities within the borders of that state. Such an order was, of course, exceedingly unusual, if not almost unheard of, but it was rendered absolutely necessary by the powerful influence and resources, as well as the unscrupulous character, of those interested in securing Dodge's disappearance. In order to thwart any plans for releasing the prisoner by violence or otherwise, and to prevent delay through the invoking of legal technicalities, Hansen and Jesse decided to convey Dodge to New York by water, and on the 16th of December, the Marshal and his five deputies boarded the Mallory Line steamer at Galveston, and arrived in New York with their prisoner on the evening of December 23. Dodge reached New York a physical wreck. How he was induced to tell the whole truth after he had pleaded guilty to the charge against him is a story in itself. A complete reaction from his dissipation now occurred, and for days his life was despaired of. Jesse, too, was, as the expression is, all in, and the only persons who were still able to appreciate the delights of New York were the stalwart Marshal and his boys, who for some time were objects of interest as they strolled along Broadway and drank deep and hearty in the cafes. To the assistants in the district attorney's office, they were heroes, and were treated as such. How Dodge finally testified against Hamel on the witness stand has already been told. As they say downtown, Jerome had never done anything else. He would have made good by locking up Abe Hamel. No one ever believed he would do it, but Jerome never would have locked up Hamel without Jesse. And, as Jesse says with a laugh, leaning back in his chair and taking a long pull on his cigar, "I guess I would not do it again, no, I would not do it again for all the money you could give me. The wonder is that I came out of it alive." When the reader comes to think about it, will probably agree with him